asifuna impithi impi impithizela. Welcome everybody, welcome the honorable members and welcome the people from the media, our officials, from different stakeholders. We will be starting with the work of today. If you remember well, yesterday we said we are going to meet two witnesses for today. Our first witness is already here. Everybody is welcome to this to this second day of the inquiry. Members, today we've got a witness in front of us who will be public. He is not going to speak in camera. He will speak publicly so that everybody sees him and everybody hears him. Let me thank him for that, because that makes our work very easy for this inquiry. What I would wish to do now, because the witness is here in front of us, we will read an oath to them. I am told that he is willing to take an oath in this inquiry. So I will just read a few paragraphs from him. After that, he will then take an oath. In accordance with Section 16 of the Powers and Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislators Act 2004, as a witness to this oversight inquiry, please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily to all the questions lawfully put to you, or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry. Notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you, expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a house or a committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17, Subsection 2 of the Powers, Privileges and Privilege Act, Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislators Act, a person who willfully furnishes a house or committee with information or make a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. Therefore, because I am already told that you want to take an oath, I would wish you to raise your right hand and say, and I will read to you, you'll just respond to what I'm going to read. I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, else but the truth, so help me God. Raise your
hand. I do.
Thank you very much. The oath has been taken in front of all of us. You'll just have to sign a paper that has been printed. I will give it to you now in a few minutes time. Honorable members, Mr. Brian Dames will speak about the corporate governance at Eskom, what he knows and what his experience and what has been taking place inside the entity. But before that, I will give to the evidence leader to lead and to lead us today before we get to Mr. Brian Dames. Over to you, Advocate Van Aar.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to yourself, to the honorable members, the guests, to the committee, and colleagues. Mr. Dames, for the record, can you place your qualifications, when you joined ESCOM, and how you grew up the ranks, when you became the group chief executive?
Thank you, Advocate. The context of my discussion this morning really is based on the engagements we've had. I do the best of recollecting the events and issues that you have raised with me. I must stress these things date back some time, several years, and I will answer your question on my history, and that is even longer. And in recalling these events, I have to make it clear that I've not gone back and analysed any documentation and aspects such as that, and I certainly will do my best endeavours to recollect these historical events. I started my career at ESCOM in 1987. I started out of the University of the Western Cape as a graduate.
Sorry, Mr. Dames, and sorry to Advocate Van Aar. Mr. Dames, could you please bring your mic a little bit closer to your mouth?
Okay, I'll do that. I think I have to move forward. The mic will not move. I started my career at ESCOM in 1987 out of the University of the Western Cape as a graduate in training at ESCOM Coburg Nuclear Power Station. I eventually trained as a nuclear physicist and thoroughly enjoyed this work. It was very unique in the country. It was a different time in our country's history. I used to have to drive every day to get to work. I could not stay where I worked. I could not, at the time, at ESCOM belong to the medical aid or the pension fund or eat where others ate. And so that was a huge challenge both work-wise, and the transformation was needed in the organization and I guess in our country. I spent a long time at Coburg and thoroughly enjoyed that. Then had an opportunity through ESCOM to go, I did other things at Coburg as well, like control systems, building simulators and things like that. It was all fun and nice. And then had an opportunity to study in the United States. I was selected, ESCOM had a leadership development program that selected middle managers in ESCOM throughout the country. There were thousands, and I got selected as one of two in the country to study in the USA to do an MBA, a full-time MBA, as well as a graduate diploma in utility management. I got selected and had an opportunity to spend time in the United States doing my MBA, as well as my graduate diploma in the management of utilities, and then returned to South Africa as head of ESCOM's Generation Information Management. I had a graduate honors degree in physics, BSc honors in physics, and also a graduate undergraduate degree and majors in computer science. So I looked after ESCOM Powers, the generation part of ESCOM's information management or technology issues, and that gave me exposure to power stations and throughout the country. It was new to me, different and new, but it was quite exciting. I got to know the rest of ESCOM. From there, I had an opportunity to move out of the ESCOM Generation Executive Committee and go to one job lower as an engineering manager at Lephalale today, the Matimba Power Station. And I took the opportunity because I wanted to learn a bit more of power stations and worked at Matimba for about 2 years and applied to be a power station manager. I was successful and was placed at Duva Power Station in Witbank, where I was power station manager for 4 years. That was a unique experience. It was difficult. It was the manager at the time told me that you can either take the easy assignments at Eskom or you can take the difficult assignments. And I took the difficult one, which was Duva. I must say, 4 years later, it was a different place. I had a great team of people that worked with me. From there, I was asked to head up Eskom's nuclear business, so I returned to the Cape. Now in charge of Kuberg and all the nuclear activities at Eskom. And it was not long, 2 years later, they called me to go back to Johannesburg and head up Eskom Enterprises, which was Eskom's non-regulated business. It had businesses all the way from Tripoli to Bamako to Lesotho to... And I had to deal with this telecoms and everything else, and we had to dispose of that and get Eskom back to its core business. I also was asked to then lead Eskom Enterprises division at the same time to then start the construction of the new infrastructure Eskom needed. Eskom changed strategy. I had to start all of that. That was my role. We all know in 2007 there was the event around load shedding. It started in the Cape. I was a member of the executive for the first time then from 2004, I believe. And in the middle of the load shedding in 2008, while the load shedding has already started, I was approached together with other colleagues to take the role of Chief Operating Officer Generation, to not only do what I was currently doing, but to then also deal with Eskom's generation business, and really to get Eskom's production capability back, to stop the load shedding. And that we did. I think it stopped in April 2008. And in 2010, I think it was just before the World Cup, I know that quite well because it was a huge, huge challenge. I was asked to then be Chief Executive of Eskom. I applied for the role and I was appointed. And I left Eskom in March 2014. Hopefully that gives you a sense of my career. I think it was about 27 years.
Thank you for the elaborate background. But I think it was deliberate for the committee to get a sense of your experience in different positions and roles at Eskom. But this interaction today will mainly focus on the period 2010 to 2014 when you became Group Chief Executive. You're aware that the committee is faced with looking at corporate governance issues at Eskom. We would like you to share with us the corporate governance at Eskom. Share with the committee the corporate governance at Eskom by reference to the governance structures, one, to the governance protocol, and three, the governance documentation.
Thank you. I'll focus on that. Before I get to talk a little bit about governance, I want to say a few things around. Firstly, I think what the committee is doing is absolutely commendable. But I do think you're too late. I think you should have done this long time ago. Governance is not just organizations, companies, organizations, countries. Does not just work on the structures, the documents, the protocols. It has to do with leadership. And leadership is hugely important in companies. And it also sets culture. I was very fortunate to have a very strong team with me in different levels of Eskom. Eskom has got wonderful, wonderful people. After the load shedding, when we went around the company and asked the people what they wanted, I can remember three things. They said many things, but I can remember three things. They said to me, deal with safety in the company, which was hugely important, the personal safety of people. Deal with the load shedding, stop that. We can't go to dinner parties. Our role as a company is to make sure we power this country. And thirdly, restore our confidence in the leadership of the company. And I've always remembered that. So when I took over as chief exec, I was very clear not to, we did not fire anybody. I wanted the whole team. They were different to me. They were, in many cases, better than what I am. And that was useful because it allows for an environment where people can disagree with you, people are different to you, you can express different views, you've got different eyes on different issues. And so I must say the context of leadership for me has always been very important. I was very clear around the leadership behaviors I expect of every Eskom leader. I even wrote it down and I gave it to them. So I think that's the first point I'd like to make. That leadership drives culture in companies. The processes, the documents, they're all there. They all work. It's the culture that you drive as leadership, and people do what you do. They don't normally just do what you say. So I want to make that point, the culture issue, and I would urge, and I remember this committee, I used to come here, and there was one particular member in this committee that used to serve in this committee, I think Dr. Kornos, that used to ask me about the leadership issues and the culture issues in the company. And those things are hugely important, and you as a committee used to do quite a lot of oversight meetings, and it gave you a sense of the culture of the people in the ground, and that was very important. And so I want to make that point, and I'll deal with the governance issues as you asked me. I think that's the first point. The second thing I'd like to just say, I would urge the committee, when I left, you may not have been too concerned, and that is maybe right. I mean, there are better people than me to do these things. But when some of my team members left after me, you should have been hugely concerned as to why they're leaving. By the time I left, I knew of my partner at the time, Paulo Flati, and the two of us were completely different, but we had a unique working relationship. We could complement each other, and we were clear, and he was leaving, and I was leaving. I only knew of two other executives, senior executives at Eskom, that was going to leave. The person that was working in my office, and the head of strategy at Eskom. And they came to me and said, we know you now, you're leaving, but we're not going to stay if you're not here. I did not know any of the other executives were going to leave. I read that in the papers like all of you. But when that happens, and after 6 months or 9 months, you've lost over 100 years of experience at Eskom in the leadership team, you should have been very, very, very worried. Eskom is a big, big company. It's the biggest company in this country. It touches all our people. I've always worked at Eskom not for what you gave me, but for the fact that I could make a meaningful difference. I don't know if any one of you have ever been to a village or a house when people get power for the first time. It is a massive empowering experience. And that's what kept us there. And even today, the people of this country, not all of them has got power. And we can't allow that to continue. Now, I want to urge you, we know where we're at, but what I've read in the newspapers recently as to the changes at the company, it's shocking. It is absolutely shocking that, I don't know the individuals, and maybe they've been there when I was there, I don't know them, but you have a big company with people, about 40,000 of them, that touches the lives of every South African, with assets that are hugely important, with obligations that stretches from here to Los Angeles, to Boston, to investors around the world. More importantly, you have assets that are power stations, and one of them is a nuclear station that you have very close to you here. And all of this needs to be in the care of people that understand this intimately. And I would urge that it's something that I think what you're doing is right. but you're dealing with historical issues. Don't have another discussion in a year's time to have a discussion of what's happened today. That's, so let me come to the governance. I do apologize for a little bit of that. So, ISKCON's governance structures has always been well-defined. Like I said, we've been absolutely blessed by very good people. We had an exceptional corporate council that played a big role in the setting up of ISKCON's governance structure. It was always well-defined. It was well-documented. I was particularly keen when I joined ISKCON or became chief exec that the company be a lot more transparent. That I had a firm belief that there's no such thing as secrets, and therefore, you know, companies get shaped by the community in which they act, not by management. And so I was, you know, and we were very clear that internally you need to have robust discussions, and that you should have very strong leadership teams. So ISKCON's governance is very well defined. It's very well structured. You have delegation of authority matrices. You have clear input, significance, materiality frameworks from the shareholder. You had a shareholder compact. You had corporate plans. These things were done by a very, very competent ISKCON strategy team. We built up a unique capability in doing strategy, our own strategy work, and doing our own corporate plans. You have very clear requirements around reporting to Parliament, to the shareholder. And those things worked. And over the years, we have certainly worked on improving the governance. The governance got expanded not only to deal with matters of investment or procurement. It started to be expanded when the power system became constrained with implementation of governance around how the power system got managed. We expanded that also with the construction program of ISKCON to include that. When we started the procurement many years ago for the large construction projects, ISKCON implemented specific requirements, the board at the time, specific requirements around how the procurement would be done, the processes internally. We changed, we created, the board instituted independent audit of each large procurement item, and that became standard practice at ISKCON. We were, for many years, had an ISKCON council. We then had an ISKCON board. This board comprised of very experienced people, sound, experienced executives. We had independent directors that were international directors on the board of ISKCON. They had huge experience in power and utility issues, and they used to be very objective because they were not attached to the country. They looked at things quite objectively. The tone around the governance certainly changed after the World Cup in 2010. With the appointment of a new board of ISKCON, I think out of all the members, it was only, I think I could recall myself and maybe the finance director and maybe one or two other members that were retained, but the whole board got replaced. And it certainly brought a different sense of tone to the organization. So the protocols were well established, the structures were there, the frameworks were well defined. We had very clear authority levels. We had very clear structures in which the organization worked, the shareholder compact, the significance materiality frameworks, the funding plans of ISKCON, the corporate plans, performance targets. I was a stickler on that. I used to do the performance contracts for the company myself. For every executive, we would align it clearly with the shareholder expectation, the corporate plan, and every executive's compact, and I would do the assessments myself at least twice a year. Out of that, the budgets for the organization. So those processes were well defined, and so the reason why I raise that is because every company has what I call a rhythm. It's very important. And the rhythm then comes into how do you do your planning, and then how do you do your reporting, which was also quite important. The executives were responsible for the day-to-day running of the company and activities thereof. We had very standard processes designed. For instance, every report that would go to the executive committee or the board would be quite structured, upfront, predefined, so that the board is well informed of all the issues that it would like to raise. It would then have independent assessments done. So if you do a procurement matter at Eskom, as an example, every procurement matter would go through Eskom Treasury. So Eskom Treasury will do the independent evaluation of whether this is the best deal for Eskom. And normally, as an executive in the company, you know, you can't bypass that. You have to go through that, and the Treasury report will independently go to the board with whatever submission you make as an executive or from anywhere in the company, together with aspects such as what are the environmental risks to the specific procurement or proposal, what are the requirements for approval, PFMA approval, Treasury approval, all of those things, executives had to apply themselves, and both Eskom Legal, Eskom Treasury would independently provide those assurances for the board. And over the years, we've redefined those standards and redesigned them and improved them. So these things were all there. We've also, through the work that the finance director did, Paul at the time, even before I got appointed, did a huge amount of work for us to really get our financing systems redesigned. You know, the payment processes got redesigned. We wrote it down. We workshopped it. It came into manuals. The reason why we did it in manuals is because you can then use that for training for people as they come in. So that got all changed, and Paul had a huge amount of work around just how would we redesign our standards within the company, such that our reporting at the time was quite innovative. We won quite a lot of awards for standard of reporting for Eskom's report, integrated report. We reported to you as Parliament on time. By the time that we were at Eskom, we could close our account 6 weeks after the year end and have it audited and submitted to the shareholder as needed and reported to Parliament and the shareholder on time, never had a qualified audit. And that for us was very important. Out of that, we had a huge amount of reporting protocols outside as well. So if that is the governance framework, and I just give you a sense, and then I'm going to give you a sense of the reporting part. Internally, we had ways of checking the internal controls of the company. And we had a very competent internal audit function at Eskom. It was done by Eskom itself. Over many years, built up a unique capability. And they would produce a thing, I don't know what it's called today, but it used to be called the Catalyst Report. Now, as a young power station manager, I was always scared about the Catalyst Report. Why? Because the Catalyst Report finds its way all the way to the Board Audit and Risk Committee and to the board. And you don't want to be in the Catalyst Report. So you want to make sure your controls, whether it's the management of your stores or the management of your debtors or a technical issue, this Catalyst Report was the internal audit report on all the audits they've done throughout the quarter, and it was done every quarter, and included, quite interestingly enough, the technical audit reports. So if Eskom would have a major technical event, or the routine technical audit reports, or for that matter, when I became chief exec, I had specific requests that I wanted audited. So I wanted, for instance, things such as, you know, the Eskom, state of Eskom, civil structures audited. Then they would go out and audit that and give me feedback, or the control of ammunition by Eskom security, things such as that, and then I would get feedback on those things. Together with this came the internal controls, the normal financial audits, the procurement audits, the technical audits. The ethics program came with it. So every quarter there was a full report on the ethics program, how many people were trained on ethics, are the ethics coordinators appointed, and that was part of the rhythm of the company. We had a whistleblower program, people could phone anonymous numbers, and this process also, once a year, internal audit will do an independent assessment of Eskom's internal controls. They'll actually rate it and say whether year on year the controls is improved or not improved. And they had access to the Board Audit and Risk Committee, and they had access to the Board of Eskom. I spent quite a few hours with them every quarter, and we would have gone through all of this as myself as a chief exec with them. And in addition to that, as I said, this would be provided to the board. There is one other issue I must just raise. Eskom also had another oversight that was very important, which was the nuclear oversight. Because Eskom is a nuclear utility, it needs to have, the board needs to have oversight of the nuclear activities of Eskom. And so I had an independent report from the oversight team at Coburg that would see me at least once a quarter and take me through all the nuclear aspects. On top of that, that would go to the Board Audit and Risk Committee. And in addition to that, there will be independent, every two years, there would be an independent peer review from international people on the nuclear activities at Eskom. And that report would also come directly to the Chief Exec and to the Board. So I think that's an important part. In addition to that, I had a little thing that I called Brian's Block. It's something that it really created problems for some of the managers, but it allowed Eskom employees to raise whatever they like with me. And this was quite useful. I got to read all of this. They used to say whatever they like. And out of this, there would be issues that I would then ask forensics to look at or whatever the case. So that became quite a source of things that needed addressing. It became to such an extent that before I read it, the managers would have taken action. So you actually get the desired result. If there were issues out of these audit reports, I normally would have addressed a personal letter to each of the executive for them to then address the issue and come back with feedback and dealt with that. For the shareholder, just very briefly, for the shareholder, we produced every quarter a shareholder report that was conclusive of all of Eskom's reporting, every part of the business, and whatever the shareholder has asked for, with performance reports. At some stage, the shareholder asked for, you know, every detail in every municipality in the country. I mean, we had to provide that 30 days, 90 days. All of that was provided. We provided the funding program because up front we had to get permission for the funding program and we had to then provide feedback on that. And as I said, these things would go through to the Exco, through the Audit and Risk Committee and the Board of Eskom. I also had a habit of providing every week to the chairman and the director general of the shareholder a weekly report. And this report would be provided by the team on all Eskom matters. I never edited the report. I would just take it and send it through to the chairman and the shareholder, the director general of the department, so that they have weekly updates. Because the power system was constrained, I used to provide daily updates through SMS, certainly to my chairman, the director general of the shareholder, the director general of energy, the minister of energy, the minister of the shareholder, the chief exec of the regulator, and they knew at least once or twice a day exactly the state of the power system and how we manage the power system every day. And that was quite important. Our trade unions played a very important role in our company. When big issues at Eskom happen, I would, over and above communicating with the chairman, the shareholder, I would talk to the chairs of the committees of the different committees of the board, but I would also call trade union leaders and make sure they understand what was going on, that they're not surprised, and that created, back to this issue, the transparency issue. The shareholder report every quarter went to Exco, to the Audit and Risk Committee, the board, and then the finance director and the Exco team met with the shareholder team and with National Treasury and worked through that report every quarter. And that allowed us to make sure that we then had a framework that then has the plans, has the governance, and then reported against that. Our interim financials we introduced for the first time at Eskom. We started producing interim financials for Eskom because we felt it was hugely important for markets and for investors and for the issue of transparency. I've spoken about our year-end audits. We've met our statutory requirements. This parliament has had oversight over us. We always came. We invited you for oversight meetings. And then the last aspect that I just want to talk about, and then I'll stop, is the management of Eskom's rating. Eskom, by the time I left, had an investment grade rating. And we understood that very clear as to Eskom's own rating and the underpin that we got from government support. This was very important for us. because we were, at the time, ran for the first time a borrowing program that was close to 300 billion rand, and for the first time went to the US to raise money in US dollars, and we were quite successful. The first time we raised it, we had 1.7 billion raised, and we were four times oversubscribed. The second time, by that time Paul has left, I was alone. We raised $1 billion, again four times oversubscribed, unguaranteed. And I know at the time we had lots of debates about should it be guaranteed or not. And we wanted it unguaranteed because we wanted to limit the use necessarily of the government guarantees. So the management of the rating agencies for us was hugely important. We met with them on a regular basis with National Treasury and the shareholder. And for that matter, we also had a ratings advisory committee or a company that advised us on ratings. And I can remember making a presentation to one of the last board breakaways I attended. We brought them to the board to explain to the board the importance of their maintaining Eskom's investment rating. And that we had an unusual uplift support, unlike other utilities in the world. And the point that we wanted to make to the board is whatever you do, don't do anything that will jeopardize Eskom's rating. And these are the important aspects of it. I think by the time that the board decided to fire four executives or suspend them many years, a year later or whatever, Eskom immediately got downgraded to junk status. And that was very important for us. Maybe I can stop there. So that's a sense of the frameworks. The frameworks were there. They were well-defined. The teams branded. There was a reporting part of it. As I said, for us, certainly the tone changed with the new board that came in, and I can, if you like, I can talk about three or four specific examples that leads to the sense of tone that was absolutely different.
In the context of leadership, I'm sure you'll agree that the relationship between the group chief executive and his or her board crucial, but more so between the group chief executive and the chairperson of the board. Can you shed light of your relationship with the chairperson of the board under which you served at the time?
I had two chairs while I was chief exec. The one had a very short tenure, and then one with a longer tenure. And the previous chairman of Eskom was also an executive chairman. Prior to me coming on to being chief exec, we normally would engage with the chairman of Eskom every quarter as leaders in Eskom. But not necessarily directly. And so we had a wonderful chair, and he's been on the board for a long time, so when he took over, it was somebody that we knew, and he knew how the company worked. I can remember, and I think I got a phone call one late evening from an editor of a newspaper saying, can we have the number of your chairman? Why? You know, because tomorrow morning we're going to run a story saying that he's not the chairman anymore. And I remember calling him very early in the morning saying, I don't know if you've seen the newspapers, but this is the headlines. And we then had the board replace the desk. We then had a new chair.
Sorry, Mr. Thomas. Who was the chairperson?
The chair of Eskom when I got appointed was Mr. Mpomo Kwana. The chair that was then appointed was Mr. Zola Tsotsi. I was the chief executive, and like I said, Paul was already the finance director. I did not particularly know the chairman of Eskom. Knew of him when I was when I worked at a power station. I remember we all used to come to Johannesburg for these big meetings, and I know that he was at Eskom, but I didn't necessarily know him. One of the first things that happened, and I was not pleased with it, was the chairman had particularly two people identified that he wanted to work in his office, Eskom people. And I was not aware of this, and he came in and said he wanted these two people appointed. By that time, the Eskom chairman and the chief exec always shared an assistant or an executive. And it's been practiced for many years, and I recommend that that's what we do, and there's no need to have added resources, but that was not the case. So it ended up with two people in the chairman's office that he selected prior to coming to Eskom, and then two people, one person that then worked with me. And part of this tone was, I would raise maybe two or three examples. I think the first time that Paul and I really, after the first year, one matter that came up was the rotation of Eskom auditors. By this time, Eskom had auditors that served for many years, and then I had to mandatorily be rotated. And so the finance team, under Paul's leadership, ran a process, engaged with the audit and risk committee, and ran a tender process and came with a recommendation. But this thing kept being debated. And we were asked to do legal opinions and audit accounting opinions on all of everybody on this list of tenderers. And I can recall one specific special audit and risk committee that was called. I was not a member of the audit and risk committee, but I was an invitee and I attended all of them. And the chairman came to those audit and risk committees. It was just prior to a board meeting and really instructed the committee to cancel the tender process. Now, Paul and I disagreed in the committee meeting. We asked for it to be minuted because as far as we were concerned, the process ran, the process was fine. This is the answer. You've asked us to do due diligence. We've done that. We've given you a response. The tender is fine. And the same matter went to the board, and again we disagreed and asked for that to be minuted. The end result of that process is that the current auditors that Eskom had was extended for another year. The next year, we then went back to the audit and risk committee and said, please, what is it that you want? And the answer was, we would like to have a black audit company. And we said, we fully support that. We think it's the right thing. You know, and let's follow the process. And we soon realized that we needed triple PFMA approval for changing the tender requirements, which we then, I personally asked the finance director to approach National Treasury and ask for the exemption. The board said to me clearly, you know, we've decided not to ask for an exemption. We will do it. We did. And we were not given the exemption. And we were quite admonished by not applying in the first case, so that why did we go and apply? In any case, the recommendation was made to the shareholder for the appointment of the auditors. The shareholder correctly did not support the recommendation from the board because there was no triple PFA approval. Needless to say, by the time I left Eskom, Eskom had no new auditors. So this is now 3.5 years later. I think after I left, some auditors were appointed. But that, in the first year then, we had the process of board evaluations, which is a very good governance process, of board self-evaluations. And I think in this board self-evaluation, the first one that was done, it was very clear that there was a distinct difference between the board members, either the staff finance director, two executive directors, and the board, around the issues of integrity, probity. And this actually led to a breakaway to mend relationships between the board and management. And even a consultant got appointed to work with us. I don't think it ever got necessarily solved. So that is one example of, I think, trying to give you a sense of the relationships. There was another matter around New Largo. So we were building Kusile Power Station, a very important power station. In Eskom's history, it's got one power station without a mine. And we were very clear that we didn't want it to end up in that position again. And so It was very important that we engage with the owner of the mining right and a big mining company to set the contract terms for this mine. And this specific mine was the first time Eskom was going to revert back to cost-plus arrangement with the mining company, where Eskom was going to contribute some of the capital. And this was really important from a perspective of the cost of the supply of coal. And we had a framework agreed with the mining company, and we could never get this approved. There was two specific requirements that I was asked to communicate with the new chief executive of this mining company that then came into office. Was that Eskom, the mine, should be owned 51% black-owned, and I have no concern and problem with that. And secondly, that the operations of the mine should be done by, should have the same ownership structure, the operational part of it. And that's the part that we were, we communicated to the mining company, and we were quite reluctant because it was the first big new mine and we wanted this mining company to do the mining. You know, his view to me was, Brian, we're a mining company, we mine, it's our business. So my view to him on ownership was, this is a requirement of the board, and secondly, we will never tell you who to pick as your mining partners, your black-owned partners, and that we leave to you. This matter did not go away. The chairman and the chairman of the tender committee came to me and said they're going to meet the chairman of this company in, I think it was London or something like that, and they're going to raise this issue. It's fine, do that. They came back to me after the meeting in London. None of the executives went with, and came back to me and said that they've reached an agreement on this structure. And I said, that's wonderful, you know. Can you do me a favor? Could you write to this person and just confirm the agreement so that we as a team can then work on whatever's been agreed to? Needless to say, they did write, and the response came back that no such agreement exists and has been reached. And this engagement went on and on, and by the time I left Eskom, I think there was no mining, there's no agreement, there's no contract. The station, I think by now, must be running. And I've always felt that engaging with suppliers directly, and I have raised it with the chairman, was wrong. Because where do they go if they have a problem? You know, if somebody engages and says, go and talk to the chief exec and I mess up, then they can go to the chairman and the board and complain and do all sorts of stuff. But if you talk to the chairman, how do you then, where do you go after that? Where do you revert? And so that was one of the issues I did raise, that the involvement in procurement matters, the involvement in engaging with suppliers was not right. Not something I was used to. I personally never served on Eskom procurement committees. It's something I've learned from my predecessors, Mr. Harler and Eskom. Never exercised my delegation for contracts and investments. I had a team of people, always all delegated to a team of peers. They can do it better than what I can on my own. And that was an issue. So those are three things. I think the last one I spoke about the board evaluation was the Kubuk steam generators. Now, I did say to you earlier that Eskom does these international reviews. And the replacement of Kubuk's steam generators comes out of this review, one of these international reviews that Eskom had a brilliant engineer at Kubuk and had one of the best steam generator health programs. But we got to the point where we were the only utility that had these old things. Now, in the nuclear business, you don't want to be on your own. You want to have others that got similar experiences because it becomes a risk for the whole industry. And the recommendation was that we should replace these things. And we then started the process of replacing this many, many years ago, even with the old board of Eskom, the one during the World Cup. And the board ran the process, and right in the beginning, the process concluded. The team got a mandate. The team negotiated with suppliers. And it was just a time when the new minister also came in, and I recall a meeting, we were all called to the shareholder, the board, myself, all of us, You know, this tender, we were asked that this tender should be cancelled because we have no approval, which we did.
Sorry, Mr. Dumps. Can you just assist us with the specifics? When you say this minister, this chairperson, can you just tell us who this minister is or who this chairperson is?
Okay. At the time, I think it was just after Minister Gigaba came into office. We certainly had, this was one of the first issues with the engagement with Eskom. It was still the board of Mr. Makwana and the previous board members. We were asked to cancel the steam generator tender for Kubuk because we had, I think, no approval. And there was concerns that raised that, you know, the suppliers were already in the country to sign the contracts. Now, as a chief exec, I was not aware of that personally. I mean, the team would not come and tell me what they're doing. They would do what they have mandate for. But it became clear that, you know, one of the key issues over the years is that communication started flowing inside of the company to outside of the company, flowing to, you know, the board would know things that I would not know or Paul would not know. And so that is was a new environment that we were not, and that was just one example. In any case, the Kubuk steam generator process, we then restarted it. We got PFMA approval, exactly what is the requirement, we got the approval, and we started the process again. This was towards the end of my tenure. The head of generation came to me one day and said, "Brian, you know, we've completed the process. And by the way, the answer is exactly the same as the first time around. And the board tender committee has not, we submitted the report, but they've not called us in to present our." What was happening is that the board got independent opinions on this procurement matter. And the chairman of the tender committee one day came into my office and said, "We've told the team we're not going to talk to them anymore. We're going to talk to you as a chief exec, and here's the independent report. We would like you to change the recommendation of the tender."
And who was the chairman?
It was
of the
Mr. Colin Najila. He was the chairman of the tender committee. And I said, as what I've always done with things, not a problem, give it to me, I'll deal with it, which is what I did. I worked with the Kubuk team extensively, with our corporate counsel, with the legal team that has supported them. And I prepared quite a detailed report and a response to each of the recommendations from the independent company. The conclusion of all of this was that the process is fine. The board should feel absolutely free to award tenders. And I think it was an award of tenders between two companies. I can't even recall the allocation of the work. And I submitted this to both the chairman and Mr. Tsotsi and Mr. Majila, and that was it. I can't recall if it was months or weeks later, Mr. Majila came back to me again, this time with a handwritten note, and I can remember it clearly. It was a white piece of paper with, I think, blue writing, if I can recall clearly, but I was quite, because it was minutes of the tender committee, and I was amazed as to why the minutes was handwritten, because there's a company secretary for Eskom. But in any case, and this was an instruction to me that we should change the tender process. I again wrote quite a formal letter back saying, "I disagree. I've given you my response. I disagree with your process. If this is an instruction of the board tender committee, I'll ask the team and the head of generation to meet with you and you can tell him what it is that you like." By the time I left Eskom, I think the process was not completed. I think I subsequently read, like all of us, in the newspapers what happened to this, and I think eventually went to the courts. But that gives you, you ask me, a sense of the relationship. That gives you a sense of some of it. Three examples, and I'd like to stop there.
Two last things for me. In the business of Eskom, clearly, there's quite a number of contractual relationship with different service providers. And you spoke about this cost-plus concept. In your tenure, from 2010 to 2014, has the shareholder, the Minister of Minerals, played any role in the contractual negotiations between Eskom and different coal suppliers? Really, don't have to limit it to coal suppliers.
You asked me if the Minister of Minerals has played any role in coal suppliers while I was at Eskom? No. Not the Minister of Minerals, which was responsible for licenses. Not to my knowledge. So that is the Minister of Minerals.
In your experience, would there have been ever a need for an involvement of a minister with the concluding of contractual negotiations between the suppliers of Eskom around coal in particular?
No. We have many years, my engagement with the Department of, I think it was then called DME, or then changed to Minerals. It's always been with the Director General and the teams, and it was more around the strategic issues around coal, because coal is important. You know, you have a regulated energy price, and you have unregulated coal market, and we could see, you know, from early that the coal market has changed, but the answer is no.
If there were to be facts presented to you of a minister, particularly of minerals, actively involved in a transaction of a purchase and sale of a mine which is a service provider to Eskom, would you describe that as an appropriate or an inappropriate conduct?
It's not appropriate.
The last question that I have relates to the circumstances under which you left. Can you just shed light why you left Eskom?
I have to give credit to my family. So a lot of pressure from them, but be that as it may. I spoke to you about the sense of communication lines everywhere. I think when you and I met, I spoke to you a little about little things I used to do in just how I would run my office. For instance, every year, declarations of interest of executives. I would have internal audit look at it, and they would do proper checks before I would sign it off. And those little processes, I would, every claim that would come, firstly, don't claim anything that is nonsense. So nobody would claim a big cell phone bill with me. They would not even bring it, because they would already go to HR and deduct the money from their salary. So because internal audit would check every claim, and little things. I had lots of little things I did that I had great predecessors that I could learn from. But what became difficult is that with these examples I gave you, it became very difficult to vouch for the governance of Eskom. I could no longer look up and have oversight up, down, sideways, back, and for the whole organization give leadership. And I think that was the essence of it. And I think Paul, my finance director, and I saw this quite early. If you would have asked me that after the World Cup and all the changes happened, I knew I was going to leave Eskom. I knew the environment was such that I would not. We will do what is right, but we could not change. And I think Paul and I got to the same conclusion at the same time. Because we were both executive directors, we used to talk quite a lot. And we got to the same conclusion to test our own views. He eventually left. I left about the same time. I decided to resign. And I resigned and asked the chairman and spoke to him on the 1st. I resigned from the 1st of February 2013. Why the 1st of February? Because that's actually when I started with Eskom in 1987, 1st of February. And after one meeting with the executive, I asked the chairman to stay behind, and I said to him, I've decided to resign, and here's my resignation letter. He was shocked. Just some context for the members. I never had a term contract at Eskom. All of us were permanent employees, so the only requirement was to give 6 months notice on both sides, company or the executive. And called the chairman was shocked. He said, listen, you can't, this can't be true. You know, please give me time to engage with the board, to engage with the shareholder and the minister, and, you know, we will meet. So we had a meeting. The board called a special meeting to discuss my resignation. Unanimous position of the board is, firstly, we cannot contemplate you leaving. Eskom can't afford you leaving. We don't want you to leave. We don't think at this point where Eskom is or the country, the issue we're facing, you can't leave. The conclusion of that was twofold. One is, tell us what you want, and we will create a special board committee to engage with you on this process of you leaving, and to talk to you and engage with you. I gave it quite careful thought as to what I would say. I could say 10,000 things is what I wanted, but I only listed 5 things. The first thing I listed was that I wanted the board to give me my performance expectations before the year start. It's a very simple request. It should be done. The reason why I did that is because for the years I had performance assessments with the chairman, I never got feedback. There was no, you're doing badly, want you to focus on this. You know, my last performance discussion was, you're doing a brilliant job, you know, you just, there's no issues. Board has got nothing. You know, there was some issues around where the board members stay in Cape Town, which hotel, and what cars they drive. That was it. So I said, please tell me your expectations. Because with all of this communication, it felt like there's this, no matter how hard we worked, we were never right. There was always something that we just never knew what it was. So that was the first request. My second request was that I would like to have control of the executive appointments. Again, very normal. All chief execs should have that. And the reason is that, you know, when I came in and we had, you know, a massive piece of strategy work, and out of that came instruction. I wanted to appoint executives in certain roles and change the exco. I was not allowed to do that. We had performance issues. Some executives that I wanted to fire, I was not allowed to do that. I think by the time I left, they also realized that, you know, one or two executives is a real problem and that, you know, we should deal with them. I wanted to move executives around to different roles because I felt different eyes, you know, different, you know, could. I was not allowed to do that. So that was the second request. Very normal request. The third one was that I asked for a chief operating officer. Because Eskom is big. Big. I've now just left Paul, which was a huge, huge support. And I wanted a chief operating officer because it was a lot of work. It's a big, big entity. So the fourth request was that I wanted my salary corrected. Now, it was a very strange request. What happened to me is I got appointed, I think Minister Hogan was still there, and Mpumi Kwana was there. I had a contract with the board, and in this contract there was a salary for me, and the chief exec. The salary was never implemented for all the years that I was at Eskom. I still earned the salary that was before I was still an executive of Eskom. So all I asked for is for this to be corrected. Every year the board would make salary increases and award bonuses and whatever, but it would be on this old thing. They knew that this thing was outstanding. And it was because of the shareholder at the time doing a study on remuneration or something like that. And I just asked for this thing to be corrected. I've always made sure that the rest of the team were properly looked after and properly dealt with. And then the last request I had was that I'd be allowed to take early retirement if I take turn 55. Like all the other Eskom executives and chief execs prior to me. And if not, then the board wants me to leave before I'm 55. that I think they pay me 1 month for every year service or something like that. But I made 5 requests. The board then had a meeting to engage me on these 5 requests. I explained it to them, clarified why these 5 things, and they understood it. I never got feedback. Nobody came to talk to me. There was no engagement. In all our public engagements with the staff of Eskom, the chairman used to publicly say, you know, Brian is going nowhere. Told the executives that, you know, this is clear, he's going nowhere. And I never got feedback. And I think at one of the board breakaways somewhere in some of these places that you go for a board breakaway, it was a particularly difficult meeting. And I had enough. And I took out the letter that I gave the chairman. He asked me to keep it. And I handed it to him that morning. It created quite a lot of anxiety among the board. The meeting stopped. This issue got dealt with. And I told them, you know, we had the discussion. I told you what I... Nothing happened. I received feedback one day on my desk. A letter would be left on my desk. And I think the letter I received said something to the effect that, we're not going to give you a chief operating officer, all of this. We accept your resignation. You can leave December 2013. That was fine. Nobody spoke to me about it. The letter was left on my desk. I continued. I think I found another job, which was important, good for me. I then, I think we got to about, I think in that period I also went overseas. I was in a meeting overseas towards the latter part, I think, of 2013. I can't recall exactly the dates. And the head of Eskom Sustainability, one of my ex-colleagues, called me while I think I was in Korea and said to me, Brian, you got a death threat. And this threat was left on your desk. We phoned your family. They are fine. We've checked with them if they know any of this. And we're looking after them. When I returned to South Africa, I had Eskom protection from that day until the day I left Eskom. There were always 3 people with me. I could not go shopping. When I played golf, I've got a weakness, I play golf. They would go with me on the golf course. It was strange. It was reported by Eskom security to the police. I've never received any feedback. I never know. And when I came back, they showed me this thing. I can't recall it clearly, but I can recall it was newspaper clippings, you know, words made of newspaper clippings. That was left on my desk. Towards the end of, I think, November, the chairman and I, in our normal meetings, I alerted him to the fact that our interim results was due, I think, very early in December 2013. And that he must remember that I'm leaving end of December, and he needs to announce it. He's not made any announcement. Nobody's come to talk to me about handover or anything like that. He then said to me, but Brian, you're going nowhere. I said, yes, I am. I said, you gave me a letter. He said, no, I never gave you a letter. I said, please, can you go check that you, just check it. He did come back to me and realize that that is the case. I got another letter on my desk, left on my desk, not discussed with me, that read the following. It said, we want you to stay until the AGM of Eskom, which was kind of like now July 2014, which normally when Eskom's AGMs would take place. I refused, because by now I had enough. I refused, and I said to them, if you want me to stay, the best I can do is finish the financial year, March. I said, but now you're going to pay me for that. I've now given up the job I had. You're going to pay me my whatever short-term incentive you decide. You're going to pay me all my long-term incentive payments. By that year, at an AGM of Eskom, the board also then corrected the salary issue for the last 4 or 3 years. And, you know, I don't know if they corrected the pension fund or all of those things had to be done. Eskom's result announcement was made on the 5th of December 2013. It's quite an important date for all of us. That day, when they announced, so the morning before we did this thing, 2 things happened to me. Firstly, they came back to me and said, here's a letter, it's fine, you can go in March. and this is the agreement that we have with you. And by the way, this is the finance director we're going to announce that we're going to appoint. I didn't know that, so I was told before that. Secondly, we're going to announce your resignation, which was done on the 5th of December 2013. It was an important day for all of us. That's the day that Madiba passed away, that evening. I remember that clearly. So that was fine. It was announced, and I was always clear when I actually entered into a contract with the board, I asked that if ever I had a dispute with Eskom, it would be settled through private arbitration, so that you don't go through this public thing that affects the company. And so I was very clear I wanted to be mature about this, that we don't fight, and because it's not good for the people, for the company. What happened in early January was that the chairman, I think, went to Davos with one of the executives. I never went to Davos while I was at Eskom because it was an important part of the year, January, for Eskom. Maintenance would have been done. Everybody comes back to work. The factory starts. If you remember the load shedding, it all happened in January. So I always stayed in office in January. And he came back and he said to me, we would like to appoint an acting chief executive while you're here. And I said, no. He said, I've got a contract with you. Yeah, well, why would you want somebody else? There's no such thing as democracy in management. You know, it's one person in charge and that's the person responsible. So I said, no. I phoned the chairman of the Remuneration Committee to check with him whether or not this is a board decision, and he said to me, no. The board is going to contract with you until December, and we expect, to March, you must stay in until March, which I did. But the chairman and the person that he's designated as acting chief executive, I assume, started having meetings with the exco without me while I'm in the office. And they said to me clearly, I don't know what they discussed, I don't know what happened. Some of the exco members did come to me and were quite uncomfortable because where's Brian? You know, Brian is in the office, why is he not here? I left it at that. But it gives the sense of the type of how you were treated. The respect was lost. The chairman came back to me. I think by this time they must have made a recommendation to the minister to make an acting appointment, and the minister did not agree with it. And he asked me for his help, so that I can talk to the minister. I said to him, no, because surely if you make such a decision, you engage with the minister, and you talk to the minister up front, and you agree. So what happened? So I refused to do that. Needless to say, I was asked to do an exit report from Eskom, from the shareholder, which I did. It was everything that was already in Eskom. And I continued my work 2 days, 2 working days before I left Eskom. The chairman and Mr. Majila and one of the executives came into my office and said that Mr. Majila would be the acting chief executive of Eskom. So I said, fine. Then they came to me and said, I must now do the handover. And I said, no. You've known I was leaving from February 2013. It's a year later. You've done nothing. To now, 2 days beforehand, come to me and ask to do a handover. I said, no. Everything is in the documentation. You read it. They also wanted my cell phone numbers because I used to, like I said, communicate with people on issues quite quickly. Everybody, whether it's informing the minister or the trade union leaders, they wanted my contact details. I refused. So, my last job at Eskom was to do a performance assessment of the head of treasury, and I left.
Just in the interest of fairness, and this is the last question. You said it would be inappropriate for the Minister of Mineral Affairs to be involved in negotiations between the contractual relationship between the service providers of Eskom on coal in particular. What is your reasoning for saying that relationship would be an inappropriate relationship?
I mean, we should be clear. I mean, the Minister is also the regulator. At some stage, the minister regulates whatever happens in mining, whether it's the Minister of Water Affairs would regulate water rights for a mine or whatever the case may be. If it's a case of mining, I guess there's mining rights. But there's no role in any procurement matter of a company other than what is allowed for within the approvals, whether it's a PFMA approval, the materiality framework where it spells out what you need to get approval for. Other than that, there's absolutely no role. I'm sure that ministers do engage with company executives from all over the world, and those should be around issues of policy.
No further questions, sir.
Thank you very much, Advocate Vanara, and thank you very much, Mr. Brian Dames, for your engagement with the leader, with the evidence leader. I'll give over to the members, Honorable Swart, Honorable Luyenge, Honorable Natasha, Honorable Gungubele.
Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Shivambu.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Dames, for your presentation. Did you receive a 30 million rand pension when you left? And that is a light note. But what is your comment on reading about Mr. Malefa receiving a 30 million rand pension for 18 months' work? Just briefly, if you could answer that. Thanks.
You'll just respond to that.
Oh, okay.
Would you just keep your response very short? Very short, because I've got a very limited time.
I do apologize, I'm long-winded. I got a pension after 27 years of somebody that resigned. The amount was not that amount. And I think even with the person currently managing my pension fund, which I took out of Eskom, it's not yet that amount.
Thank you, and we know that that is subject of part of this inquiry. Now, part of what we are looking into is the whole repurposing of Eskom governance, the whole issue related to state capture by political persons and, of course, the Gupta family amongst other family members. But going back to your time, were you aware of any allegations of corruption, and what steps did you take at that stage? We know there was a lot of questions around the Chancellor House Hitachi deal. What steps did you take to address those concerns that were in the public domain and that Parliament also was aware of at that time?
Sorry, before you respond, Mr. Dames, I just want to caution the members. Members, you have 10 minutes to engage with Mr. Dames. The responses, his responses and your questions will amount to 10 minutes only.
Very briefly, and you're welcome to supplement your answers in writing as well.
Yeah, if you would, if that is needed, certainly we'll do that. With all issues around allegations, like I said, there were many ways of which they would come into Eskom, the whistleblower program, Brian's blog, all of that. We would have that investigated, even if it was executives. I never judged any allegation. Forensics did that, and we would investigate either internally or externally. The issue that you raised, particularly around Chancellor House, just to give you background, I said to you that we've improved the governance when the big bulk procurement happened. One of the things that we did was that we separated the evaluation of tenders through the Eskom teams, but we also implemented an independent assessment for the board, a probity assessment for the board on tender matters. We, as a team, and the independent assessment picked up the Chancellor House issue at the time. That was reported to the board very explicitly, clearly. Actually, the outcome of the tender the first time around was that Hitachi was not going to get the tenders. It was actually Alstom. The second time around, when we had to rerun the process, we again raised the issue with the board at the time, made them clear on it, checked the Chancellor House issue. And I think subsequently to that, as been reported, the public protector also looked at that specific procurement. So we've taken action on all of those issues.
You referred to changes that took place when Minister Gigaba was appointed. And would it be correct to say that the level of political interference increased from that day on? And was that an issue relating to your relationship at Eskom? That's the first part. And then secondly, the acting CEO that was appointed, Mr. Machila, soon after, within a month of his appointment, finalized the 43 million rand New Age deal. Were you involved in the New Age deal at all? And if so, or if not, what is your comment on him finalizing that within a month of him being appointed?
To answer your first question, there was a lot, like I said, the communication seems, you know, many a meeting we attended, I think in one particular meeting an official from the department accused me of lying and I got very angry. And what I realized is that information was being fed that I or Paul had no knowledge of. And so it became difficult. That's why I left. We had an engagement with the New Age. It was absolutely public. We had newspapers. There were the breakfast shows. I always gave the team guidance to make sure it's consistently dealt with all other newspapers, not to treat anybody unfairly. But I told you about the steam generator thing. That very same engagement to ask to address the steam generator, I was also asked to, I think, have some thousands of copies of the newspaper thing, which I also said, we'll deal with it. And the team did. I gave it to the team. Always clear, make sure you follow your governance and be consistent. And the team's result of that whole process was they sought the mandate, I think, if I recall correctly, to have newspaper contracts. The mandate was not wanted. They came back to me and said, this is not wanted. I said, what do we do? I said, please go back to the procurement committee and tell them you close the mandate because you're unsuccessful. And we left the matter there. I then read, like you have, about the thing happening afterwards.
Thank you. Part of our challenge is looking historically, but also what is happening presently. And I think you correctly say some of the issues. It is a bit late, but it's better late than never. Just on the issue of the Coburg generator replacement, is it a concern to you that it still has not been replaced at this stage as an energy expert? And does that present a threat to South Africans living in the Western Cape?
That's a big question. The Coburg team is hugely experienced. I think we're very fortunate. I do apologize, Chair. By the time I left Coburg, the Coburg team invited me back one night. It was early in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they invited me to switch off the reactor. Because by the time I left, it was the first time in Eskom's history that this power station ran from an outage to another outage, and they wanted to give me the honor to switch the reactor off, which they did, which was quite unique. So you have a very competent team at Coburg. You have a very competent team to look after the steam generators at Coburg. The Coburg steam generators should be replaced.
The issues relating to the Unit 4 turbine and the Unit 3 boiler at Duva, that was during February 2011. But we understand that the final tenders for the repair are only now being awarded. Surely that is also totally unacceptable, the time delay and the alleged 2 billion rand increase in the Dongfang bid. Do you have any comment on that, seeing as that was on your watch at that stage, and now we are almost 6 years later and there doesn't seem to be any finalization in that degree as well, again indicating high levels of, let's put it, political involvement or certain families' involvement in that when it came to the consultants involved?
Just to add, Advocate Verona, when he spoke to me, raised a whole list of issues with me. And I did say to him, you know, the New Age, what happened after I left, I can't comment on it. The T-Systems things that happened after I left, I can't comment on that. The Duva boiler procurement that happened after, I can't comment on that. But I give you a view on what happened when I was there. The Geta Coal contracts, I can't comment on that. McKinsey or Trillion that I read in the newspapers, I cannot comment on that. Impulse, and so I think there's so many of these things. That, but you have the booklet, and let me go back to the steam generators. The Kubuk turbine failure that happened, I think 2011, happened after maintenance activity, and it also was because of the same unit failed in just after I left Dover's power station in 2004. What we would do with a major event like that, firstly, we would make a public announcement, but internally to Eskom, the power station manager's role is to make sure he looks after the safety of people first, then the safety of the plant, so if there's a fire, to contain that. We would then launch an investigation from Eskom, a technical, it would be a major event declared. You would then get the insurance company intricately involved because the plant is insured. They would lead the investigation, the root cause. They will tell you when to start repairs and how to repair. In that case, we appointed the original equipment manufacturer. Normally, you would get them, I think it's whatever company, would then be brought in to rebuild the turbine. In the case of the boiler procurement, the boiler failure, I know the boiler failed. I don't know when it failed. I think it was either the last month I was there or the last day. What I do know is by the time I left Eskom, I had no root cause as to why the failure happened, nor can I comment on the procurement. So for me, what I read, it's quite unusual. The other point I made to you earlier is that Treasury at Eskom is hugely competent and would evaluate what is the best value for money in all Eskom procurement.
Thank you. And my time's almost finite, but just your comment, firstly, briefly on the death threats that you received. Is there any reason why, have you speculated as to what would you, why would you have received it? Was it information that you might disclose? Have you received any threats come into Parliament before us today? And then lastly, your comments, if any, on the financial statements of Eskom at this stage. We know we've got they've got 3 billion rand irregular expenditure and the decrease in operating profits compared to how you would have liked to have seen the company operating. Thank you.
I've never speculated on the death threats. I mean, I can like be quite busy when you work. So this is a matter that Eskom Security looked after me quite well. They really looked after me. I don't know what happened with the police thing. Coming here, I hope nothing happens. So I'm not taking.
So you haven't received any threats, right?
No.
Thank you.
No. And then on the Eskom financial situation. We had, this thing was all one equation, and this equation we've agreed with the whole of government as to how do you construct assets with a balance sheet that has got no equity in it and is still valued on assets that were historically valued. And we've had many debates of this in Parliament. And so the equation of what Eskom had to borrow, what Eskom had to do as its own savings, the responsibility, and then this guarantee support framework, and then the loans. All of that was a delicate equation. And so when we did the price application, in whatever year I was still there, it solved the equation. The day, and we made this very public, including to this committee, the day that the outcome was different, we made it clear that Eskom's financial viability is significantly under threat. We made that publicly clear in our statements of financial report. But we have...
Sorry, Mr. Damas, your time with Mr. Swart is up. I want to defer to everybody. I will now give over to...
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. In order to save time, I will ask the indulgence of Mr. Bryan to note my few ballot questions, and then I will come back if I still have time. You seem to be a professional, and also you have all the experience that is necessary for one to be in the positions that you were in at Eskom. So during your stay, what were the worst memorable instances that you can remember, maybe being bogus kind of instructions given, illegal interference and interventions at your time, the most memorable one. On issues of monitoring and evaluation, what was your role in terms of ensuring that the unit of M&E is actually doing its work when you have the the twice per year assessment exercises, and in that you have referred to good people at ESCOM, commendable and with needed experience. Now, what was good about people who chose to run away instead of sitting with you, identify a remedial action to be taken, giving guidance to the whole institution? What was good about those people? And then how do you regard the intervention by then Minister Gigaba in the department? Would you justify that as an intervention or interference? If so, how do you then regard, how do you regard that as intervention if it was, or interference? And then elaborate a little bit on that one. What was illegal and what was unprocedural in his involvement in the activities of the board? And is there any ESCOM board member or staff member who actually benefited out of that tender? Are there any exterior forces that you can know of who were also beneficiaries of the decisions that you actually took, both at a management as informed by the governance kind of illegitimate mechanisms for you to do your work? And if those forces you know of, can you mention one or two? The other issue, how best can you qualify the monetary value losses of ESCOM during your era as a result that actually culminated to the exodus of the management people, including yourself, at the end? At any stage, did you ever set collectively as the group of concerned managers of ESCOM and determined exactly the road that you foresaw as being taken by ESCOM, and it is not to the benefit of the poor masses of the country? I think I still have a minute, yes, sir.
No, you have 10 minutes to interact with him and him responding to you. Actually, now you are left with 7 minutes for him to respond.
Yes.
If you still have questions, the 7 minutes will be up before he responds.
No, you must just get there now. Those are the questions that I want responses on. That will be just a single kind of a follow-up. Over to you, Guru.
I will do my utmost. You've asked very, very difficult questions. I think the first question is, what has been the worst incident of illegal interference while I was with ESCOM? Am I right? That's the first question. I think I raised these three things I mentioned earlier. Like I said, I can't recall, there may be other things, but you know, the issue of the steam generators for me was wrong as to how that was done. The fact that we still don't have a contract for a power station. Those are some of the things that I've mentioned. The worst incident while I was chief executive of ESCOM was the fatality of people, the day that six people died at Angula. that was the worst incident. So hopefully I've answered your question. Then you've asked me the monetary evaluation. The monitoring and evaluation unit, I presume you mean the unit in government that does monitoring and evaluation during us working with them. We have, like I said, we provided for the shareholder, National Treasury, quite a comprehensive report of Eskom's performance. It had all aspects of Eskom's performance. If we were asked questions from the monitoring and evaluation unit, we would respond to those, but we had no direct engagement necessarily with the unit, and I assume that our performance report would then go to them if that's how government works. So if I can stay there. You talk about people running away, and I would not say that other executives ran away. I left first. Paul and I left. It's important that you change that you can, and those that you can't, you find another place. And we have tried to talk to people. I think at the time it was very difficult. Maybe we didn't articulate it properly. You know, none of this was there at the time. It was just a sense of how we could see things would unfold, and those things that you can't tangibly put your finger down. But we have tried to talk to people and say to people, you know, people did ask me, why am I leaving? And I did explain why that is the case. Maybe I was not good at trying to explain that. But we've not really sat down and made an assessment. And I would not say the other team members, I don't know why they left. I've never spoken to them, and I do see some of them. But you have lost, not only in the executive. When I ran Eskom, I had 3 levels of looking after the private system of people that was quite close to me. One was in my office, Kanan, and he used to head up system national control. The other one was the head of system operations. He was a general manager. And then the other one was the head of risk at Eskom, who was an executive committee member. All of them came out of national control. It was very important for me because it was something I didn't know. And I think today none of them is at Eskom anymore. And for me that is, it would be a massive loss for any company. How do I regard the intervention of the department as intervention of interference? Some of it were intervention, some of it was very positive. We had a power system constraint, and we needed to communicate energy saving and all of that. There was great support for that. Some aspects there were interference. I would, for instance, get to the department with my chairman, leave a meeting, and then Eskom employees would be sitting there, and I said, what are you doing here? And, no, we were called to come and it was for me wrong. You know, the communication was not always clear. So I think it's a bit of both. That made it very difficult to manage. As I said, the communication becomes very difficult. Illegal and procedural, who has benefited out of tenders, external forces, beneficiaries of management. If there were issues against management, and there were issues of some of the executive committee members, and all of them, without an exception, I investigated. And some states, they did not like it, and I would give them feedback, and if there were matters to be taken forward, in one case, I decided to do the discipline myself. I would discipline. And that's how we've dealt with it. But external people, I don't know. I mean, I can't comment. I think one should. So when these issues happened, we did investigate. You know, even earlier matters, way back, we investigated. We got external help. We investigated it, and we would deal with the action needed to deal with it very, very transparently. From that perspective. I didn't understand the second last question around the best to quantify the money during my tenure, the management exodus. So when I was there, I don't think there were any management exodus. The turnover in Eskom was quite low. It was seen as, amongst MBA graduates, the best place to work amongst engineers, the best place to work. A lot of them has left afterwards. I can't quantify the loss of that. Whatever during my tenure was there is transparently reported in ESCO financials, and one can, you know, for instance, the issue of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. It's quite a thorough process in ESCO. Certainly when I was even a young station manager, you know, you look at every item, you report that, and that goes all the way up, and you look at the significance of that, gets checked by internal audit, and that's all clearly reported in the ESCO financials.
Could you reserve the other questions and try to write them down and respond with something that has been written down, because he took too much time and he gave you less time to respond. That's unfortunate. Your time is up. Ms. Mazzoni?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Damas. Given the time constraints, I'm going to be very blunt, and I think you know me well enough from my time on the committee when you served to know me as such. Mr. Damas, at any time during your tenure as ESCOM CEO, were you ever asked to meet with or consult with any of the Gupta family members or Mr. Salim Issa? Did anyone in your executive that you know of, were they requested to meet with any of the Gupta family members or Mr. Salim Issa? In 2008, when we had our big load shedding incident, it's quite well known that ESCOM had taken absolutely no action to remedy the stockpiles being depleted. Now, there is a theory of thought that says that our coal stocks were depleted deliberately, so that by the time we realized the extent of the damage of load shedding, coal had actually doubled in price by the time ESCOM was buying this. Now, Mr. Damas, under your tenure, the negotiations for Glencore mines and the coal restructuring developments have started already. Can you explain why the sudden increase in the price of coal and what you did about that? Chair, it's interesting that, you know, if one looks at the structure of this, Mr. Damas served for the longest period of any CEO at ESCOM. He served for a period of just over 4 years. And in the last 4 years, we've seen 6 CEOs. Now, what's also telling is that your director general at the time that you were CEO left, was not reappointed as director general when you resigned, but then in 2014 became one of the acting CEOs of ESCOM at the time. Do you know of any interference perhaps that Mr. Matona might have been involved with any foreign, when I say foreign, I mean people that weren't in government, requesting certain benefits? And then, Chair, allow me to just take Mr. Damas back to Hitachi, because I think that was touched on far too lightly. The Hitachi deal was an enormous embarrassment for our country, Chair, and there's just no doubt about that. In fact, Chair, the United States Securities and Exchange Commission charged Hitachi for making improper payments which were inaccurately recorded with the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act due to the ANC connection with Hitachi in the $2 billion Medupi power plant deal. Now, Mr. Damas, this did happen while you were CEO, and I understand that you say that you reported it. But sir, I must say that I don't think that you reported it with a loud enough voice, because I certainly never saw, as a member of the Public Enterprises Committee, any concerns that you had raised about any improper dealings with Hitachi. And I'd like to know to who you reported this, because clearly they ignored the report. And that indicates that they must have known of wrongdoings with this deal. So if you could just elaborate further on how you reported this massive deal. Chair, the World Bank gave South Africa one of the largest loans it's ever given out for the Medupi power station build. Chair, the cost overruns and the time overruns are enormous. And this was greatly due to tender processes being highly irregular, and that's in the public domain. Obviously, Mr. Damas was CEO for a great part of this. Mr. Domus, I'd like to know from you, who did you report these 10 irregularities to? Because, you know, this has cost our country billions of rand, and also most certainly has led to one of the reasons that Eskom's had gone through the downgrades, and our country suffers because of these downgrades. And Chair, I'm going to stop there so that Mr. Domus has a full time.
Thank you, Chair. The first question around the engagement with the Guptas or Mr. Issa, I was asked to meet with them. I didn't know it was them. I was asked by the minister's advisor. He came to me one day and said he would like to meet some people. I didn't know who the people were.
Sorry, Mr. Damas, you were asked to be specific when you speak about this. When you say the
The advisor of Minister Kigaba, I think it was a gentleman called Mashlango, Siyabonga Mashlango, that asked me to see some people. He arranged a meeting where I was present. It was somewhere in Midrand. And there was one other individual in this discussion. I don't know at the time the individual. I've given up until today if you give me. I assume it was one of the brothers. And after this meeting, I was quite angry. I was very angry. I actually called Mr. Mashlango and said to him, you will not bring these people to me again. It was a very strange discussion. You know, there were three items mentioned. One was, you know, kind of like, if I can recall, it went like this, you know, we've decided we can work with you. I don't know who we was. It was, you know, there was a request for a co-contract to Letabo, and it was very strange because, you know, Letabo is a unique power station. It needed no additional coal. There was a request for another coal station after Madupin Kusile, some coal-free thing. And then there was the newspaper thing, and that was... But I left and I told him, I don't think I've ever met them, Mr. Issa. I have not. I can't recall on the executives. I can't say whether they have met or not met. About the load shedding and the coal stockpiles and the theory that this was deliberate and then Glencore and the increase in coal prices. The 2008 load shedding, I was asked, as I said earlier when I gave you the career, my background in my career, I was a member of the Eskom executive in 2007. Actually, many people don't know that even while I was at Enterprises, when the Kubuk Bolts thing happened, I was asked by the chief executive to come down to Kubuk and deal with the matter. Not necessarily the Bolts thing, it was another unit at Kubuk that was down. And I spent many a day and night in Cape Town without sleeping to deal with that. And when the load shedding then happened, and the load shedding happened, I must tell you, you know, as executives of Eskom, with all of Eskom's customers, we heard about load shedding at the same time. And it was announced and it happened. And this went on, I think, in January 2008. By February, I was asked to take over. And one of my first tasks was to visit all the power stations. I did over a weekend. I visited each and every power station and their teams. And when I flew over the power stations, it was very clear for me that there was no coal. There was no coal. I remember Kendall clearly. You know, for me to see the bottom of the Kendall stockpile and the brown sand which formed the base is wrong because the Kendall stockpile needs to be as high as the trees. It was very clear there was no coal. I came back to the board of Eskom at the time. They asked me to give them an assessment. I gave them an assessment both of the plant condition and the coal situation, what we needed to do to fix it. We then worked right up to the World Cup and beyond to start dealing with the Eskom plant and the Eskom coal. We bought coal. We got a mandate from the board properly assigned. We bought coal for Eskom. We worked with coal mining companies. We worked with, interestingly enough, logistics companies. Some of the country's leading logistics companies came to assist us. So how would you move all of this stuff around? And I think by April that year, load shedding stopped. We restored Eskom coal stockpiles. You'll also recall that we increased the coal stockpile levels. We did a risk assessment per power station. So the coal pricing, we have been very transparent in how that got done with the regulator. We've been absolutely transparent. One of the issues that we have raised and there was questions about Minerals Department with the policy, the regulator, was you have an unregulated coal market, and it was very clear that coal prices in South Africa was not just Eskom, was not just the only market. There was a market outside of Eskom as well. And that was becoming quite clear. The other big thing that moved Eskom coal prices was the fact that the cost plus mines was producing a lot less. And if you don't get coal from the mine right next to you and you have to buy coal and transport it, you more than double the price. But the coal pricing, we have, there's a lot more competent people than I. The head of coal was a lady, was firstly Dan Marakani and then Kiran Maharaj, very competent, Kiran particularly. I think eventually she also got suspended, but they procured the coal. We were very transparent with the regulator on the pricing and what are the issues with the pricing. You asked me about the Glencore thing. Just some background to the Optimum coal mine. I was a young power station manager in the Woodbank area. We had a mine called Middlebrook Mine Services. It just so happened Optimum is right next to us. So many years ago, with the load shedding, when I was a member of the executive, I was not responsible for generation. There was a request for Billiton, which owned that mine, to sell its mine to Optimum Coal Holdings. Amongst the executive, I was against it. I was not head of generation, I was not responsible for coal, but I was against it, and because, you know, if Billiton can't mine the thing, you know, somebody else. When I did this helicopter trip, through that process, I arrived at the Ndrina power station, where Optimum is. When I arrived at Ndrina, two things struck me. One is that there was a mountain of coal. And when I asked the power station manager, what happened over years, Ndrina had a significant fine coal, and this stuff got wet and really became an absolute nightmare for the power station to deal with, and contributed to a great extent to the fact that they could not produce. And they asked me to fix this. The request for Eskom to consent to this transfer of ownership of Billiton came back when I was head of. I agreed with my team that we were going to fix the Ndrina problem. So what we did is we asked them to take this fine coal out, give us less coal. We then improved the coal quality specifications. We then increased the penalties. And we asked specifically that the rehabilitation fund, as required by the regulator, be funded in cash.
Thank you very much for answering those questions. We'll now give over to Honorable Kongobeng.
Where is the timing? Thank you. I was also timed myself. Thanks, Mr. Damas. I'll try to ask short questions and then we'll interact as quick as possible. Just to, if you can tell, who this chair, you spoke about the chairperson who came to risk committees, if I understood you correctly, and then started giving directives in a manner that is not supposed to be. And you and Paul express your disapproval. Who is the chairperson?
It was Mr. Tsotsi.
What was his response to our disapproval?
The board noted our disapproval, ministered that in the committee, the committee made the same recommendation to the board. The board noted that, and again we minuted it, but they cancelled the tender.
Which tender was cancelled?
It was the appointment for the auditors.
If I get you, you say there was a direction that a black auditors be appointed, and then you recommended a particular process for that to be done. Can you repeat what that process was?
After the first year, which we've just discussed, we gained the requirements of the audit committee, which was that, you know, the direction is that we would like to transform our auditors. We agreed with that. We were quite clear in doing that, that if you have a specific outcome, you needed to get exemption to as to how you would evaluate that. And we were clear that that's what needed to be done, and we did that, and we did not get the exemption. So, National Treasury, the procurement officer. I can't recall specifically the reasons, but I think there was no compelling reason from Treasury's perspective as to why you needed to change the tender evaluation criteria.
The Kusile saga, I use the word saga, mining and board members interacting with suppliers. Can you quickly repeat what exactly is the story there?
I mean, we needed to take our understanding with Anglo, high level, I think we had a memorandum of understanding, into a firm mandate to negotiate a contract. And there was a requirement for both the ownership of the mine and the operations to be changed, the engagement with the board directly picked that up with Anglo. It is unusual.
It's either we say it's irregular or unusual, which is the correct one?
To engage with the
line, which one is correct? Is it irregular or unusual? It may be unusual and regular.
If you're part of the adjudication of the outcome of what you've negotiated, it would be irregular. You should recuse yourself. To engage with the supplier at a strategic level, I would not necessarily say it was definitely unusual in the in Eskom sense.
In other words, you say the board members would be required to intervene in doing what, in case there's a problem in the process. What makes it unusual?
What makes it unusual is because the matters of procurement would normally be left with the executive, both in Eskom and the executive of the company. So the specific reply, for instance, from this company was also clear that in terms of their governance, you know, the chairman of the company not normally get involved in the procurement or contract negotiations.
There's an issue of a trip to Paris by the big technical committee sponsored by Areva. And this happened in 2013 December. You are still the CEO. Areva, which seemingly irregularly later got the Quebec steamers. What did you do about this? Are you aware of this trip? And was it usual or irregular? And what did you do about it?
I know about the trip. Let me give some background. The Board Audit and Risk Committee, as I said earlier, has got the responsibility for the nuclear oversight of Eskom. We have, for many years, taken board members as well as executives that don't have nuclear experience that has to serve in those oversight committees to training. And the particular training was in the USA at MIT, a nuclear course for non-nuclear engineers. And our board went on that as soon as it came, as part of the induction, as part of the training, we sent them to the U.S.
Trip sponsored by Areva?
No, it was in the U.S. and Eskom paid for that, so we paid for our board members to go on the training. The training was done by MIT, and it was through our membership of the IMPO, the World Association of Nuclear Operators in the U.S. Now, I received a request late in 2013 from the head of generation saying that the board members now wants to have exposure not only to the U.S. but also to the French. you know, this trip came to me. I said to him, and he dealt with it. The trip came. The previous time, I had a bit of a problem with part of the trip. I tell you why, because some members wanted to do other things. So they went on the trip. It was paid for by Eskom. It should have been paid for by Eskom. And they wanted training now from the French perspective, not just the American perspective. What happened on the trip? I didn't go on the trip. The head of generation, which was responsible, went with the board members on the trip.
Who sponsored that trip finally?
We must check. Eskom was supposed to pay for the trip and sponsor pay all costs.
You got no memory of a trip sponsored by Arriva?
Should not have been sponsored by Arriva. The training would have been done by Arriva.
You have no knowledge of that.
The training would have been done by Arriva, but the payment for executives or board members to go should have been done by Eskom.
To the minister intervening on steam generators. The process of bidding was done, recommendations being done. The board signs off. The minister says no approval. Was the minister correct?
We have to go and check. I must go check.
Were you not there when the minister said there was no approval, said we should not go ahead? Is this the time when you're still a CEO?
No, it was prior to me being the CEO when the process started. I was the CEO when we had the meeting with the minister. The board would not have proceeded without the PFMA approval. So, you know, we can go and recall. We have agreed and we have cancelled the tender and we started it all over again.
So the minister's intervention would have been, I want to use your term now, would it be unusual or irregular? Or if it's irregular, what clause in the Treasury regulations could have been breached?
So, like I said, we will have to go and assess exactly the approvals. It was certainly unusual.
This is my last question. Let me ask you this question, Mr. Damas. You are a CEO. You've been in this area. Is it correct for the minister to intervene at that level of supply chain process? At that level of procurement, to take such decision of saying what the board has signed off should not go ahead?
If there's no proper approvals, certainly the shareholder must take the correct action. So if there was no proper approval, no proper process, it is not correct for the shareholder just to sit back and do nothing.
So were there proper processes in this instance?
That was my understanding of the process, yes.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Honorable Shivambo.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think I'm going to have very few questions, maybe three maximum questions. I just want to confirm the timelines that you said you have been in the executive of Eskom since when? I want the quick answers, yes. Before you became chief executive, you went executive for how long?
From 2004.
From 2004. And then you were appointed in July 2010. And that time the chairperson was Mpho Makwana and the minister was Barbara Hogan. And then you characterized that the board at that time was well-defined and the governance structures were well-documented and the board was competent and it was not conflicted as well.
Certainly had governance structures well defined before and after that time, and we had a very competent and board.
And then Malusi Gigao was appointed in November 2010, and then he then started to interfere from April 2011 with procurement processes. And that happened before, where a minister interferes with procurement processes.
I have no experience engaging with ministers or the shareholder while I was an executive. That was normally the domain of the chairman and the chief exec. The one engagement while I was chief exec was particularly before the World Cup. We had a particular challenge with all our unions striking. And in that case, because of the importance of it, the minister worked with us. The minister at the time was Minister Hogan, around the relationship and the negotiations with the unions. But that was the only matter, to my knowledge, that the minister assisted us on.
I'm interested now in the meeting which you said was organized by Mr. Mahlangu, the advisor of the minister, Maluleke Mikaro. What did he say when he called you to organize that meeting? He said one of the brothers was there. I don't know which brothers. I refer to the Guptas, Gupta brothers.
I can't recall exactly the discussion. I think I can recall something to the effect that you would like you to meet some people. That was prior. At the meeting, there was one individual there. I think it was one of the brothers, the Gupta brothers.
Does one of the individuals look like this?
I can't remember.
Don't remember the face, but... And then that person spoke as we want to work with you and everything else there.
That's correct.
So you can't remember whether it was one of the Gupta brothers or not?
I assumed that it was one. It was not somebody that was very public or with pictures and things like that, that I would immediately recognize the face, you know.
And then you then told that person, Mahlangu, did you report that person to the minister to say that your advisor has taken me to some meeting which is discussing internal affairs of ESCOM?
No, I have not.
And then your broad picture in terms of the financial state of ESCOM when you arrived and when you left, because you said that at some stage you borrowed 1.7 billion and at some stage 1 billion without guarantees and everything else. Can you just paint us that picture?
In about 2009-2010, we needed to do a whole lot of work around how would you deal with ESCOM's financial sustainability. And we worked very closely with government, all departments, around how this should be done. The end result of that is that we had a responsibility around the build program. We had the capital, we had the operating costs, we had the coal costs, all of that. So that's the one part of the equation. The second part of the equation is, would we sell part of ESCOM? How would you fund that? The decision was that we would get the guarantees, and the guarantees would be increased, and part of that would be ESCOM's funding programs. Now, so the equation was, this was the tariff path for ESCOM going forward, this was the cost structures, capital expenditure, and this is the guarantees you have, this is then the funding program. That program said that we needed to raise 300 billion rand. That was the equation. By the time I left, I think we raised 90-odd% of that. Part of that funding was the funding drawing markets, particularly the markets in the US, which ESCOM never drawn used before. So we raised funding in the US. We had a $4 billion program, medium-term lending program, and we started the first fundraising, which was $1.75 billion. That was oversubscribed, and then later on another $1 billion. That was all part of the funding program. The World Bank loan is part of that, and the South African domestic markets was part of that.
So why didn't you require government guarantees?
No, we had the guarantees. We had the guarantees. So it was a function of the pricing of the loans and both guaranteed and unguaranteed. So if it's guaranteed, certainly it is priced better. We believe that the fact that ESCOM was supported by government, which is well recognized by the rating agencies, that the guarantee was implicit, not explicit. We were quite clear that the less of this we can burden the state with, the better. Use the ESCOM balance sheet, the ESCOM strength of its balance sheet, you know, to raise the funding, which we successfully did.
Then in your assessment, is when you left ESCOM, was it in a healthy financial status?
When I left ESCOM, one of the parts of this equation did not work out, which was the price application. We raised very publicly that this creates a massive concern. We had the power system that was very constrained. We needed to use more expensive sources of power. And one of the tasks I was given before I left And we gave a little waterfall as to what we can do to close this gap. It was a massive gap of money. But one of the things we needed to do was to come up with a savings program inside of Eskom. And I was asked before I left that I complete this and leave it with Eskom to implement. We got a team together. We worked a program of about 60 billion rand of saving opportunities. We had the board approve every step of it. And by the time I left, there was a program in place that needed to be implemented around how you then can Eskom bring its part in terms of savings.
Did I understand you to be saying that the major reason that led you to leave Eskom was because the board was interfering with procurement and what otherwise could be management decisions and processes?
As I said, I think my words were, I could not vouch anymore for the government looking up, looking down, you know, having oversight over everything while leading a company. It just became quite difficult to manage all of this. And that was, you know, it's difficult to put in words. And there was a lot of examples that I gave to deal with that.
Chair, I think that the examples that you gave, the only instances where the board, the chair or any member of the board interfered with procurement, or there are additional ones which you can make submissions on?
When I spoke to the advocate, you know, that's what I can recall. Those are the big, there may well be others that I'm not even aware of. And, you know, I can think through those. But, I mean, these are the things that for me stood out to the issues of process being completely unusual that just never happened for the 27 years I was there, or the 20-odd years.
No, thanks, Chair. I have no further questions, but I wanted to request that perhaps we should ask Mr. Brian Demons to remember the instances of procurement interferences and then make a formal submission so that we're able to take note of the instances where the Zolatsotsi-led board made a wrongful interference in procurement and management processes of Eskom. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shivambo. I think that would be proper. It can be done. I think, Mr. Damas, you don't have a problem in doing that. We can do that. Honorable Singh.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And just in connection with the last point, I think it would be appropriate for if all witnesses are invited to make written representations because of the time constraints they have here, because there may be additional information that they may want to provide to the committee. But just to go to my questions, and then you can answer all of them together, Mr. Thomas. I think thank you very much for availing yourself to the committee. I think it will certainly help us in reaching conclusions which will benefit the majority of South Africans. But I asked this question yesterday, and I just want to ask it of you in no accusatorial way, but just to ensure that the credibility of this process is above board and that critics out there don't feel, well, Mr. Damas had an axe to grind against A or B or C, and this is why he's here before this committee. Maybe you can speak to that as in your response. My second question relates to load shedding. I know Honorable Mazzoni asked you about it. But, you know, we've been told in our committee here by certain board members that the magic wand was in the hands of one Brian Molefe, and he's the one that cured load shedding. What would you say to that kind of statements that are made to us here in this committee, that it's through him, his intervention, that load shedding is a thing of the past? My third question is, during your time as CEO, and I know it may not have fallen directly under Eskom and public enterprises, but IPPs, what was your thinking with the relationship with IPPs? Because yesterday we heard that they can provide electricity at a cheaper price to the South African public. And lastly, my question relates to the nuclear, proposed nuclear deal. Now, you are a nuclear physicist, and I'm sure your experience in that arena will be able to help us map out the future. What is your thinking on the proposed nuclear deals that are envisaged to be signed by this government? Thank you, Chair. Just wanted to give you more time to respond.
On the first question, I was approached by the advocate. I'm a South African, as much as all of us. And if any small contribution can help, we should do that. This is our country. We are passionate about this country. These organizations are usually important for our people, not for people that work at them. We all just, I used to say to Eskom people, we're guardians. We called each other guardians. What's a guardian? You look after something for the time that you're there, you leave it in the hands better for those that come behind you. And we look after this for our kids and the future. And to a great extent, you asked me to help. I'm here to help. Load shedding and the magic wand. I don't know why it's been load shed and I don't know how it stopped. I can't comment whether it's a magic wand or not. We worked very hard from this position that we were in from 2007. And actually quite interesting, if I can give you advice. You know, in 1998, you made a decision not to invest in power. It takes 10 years to see the problem coming out. It takes you 10 years to solve it. We knew that. We always knew that that is the cycle. By the last corporate plan we did at Eskom, we knew South Africa was going to have excess capacity in 27. We even identified the power stations that you would have to shut down. We knew that the economy was not growing. The fact that you don't have excess capacity today in South Africa is the fact that this economy is not growing. And that should be what... It's a good problem to have. You had the same problem in 1998 and you did nothing about it. So I don't know how load shedding could stop or not, but I wish I was at Eskom now. the last time that Eskom was in a position that I was in was most probably in the late 70s when the country went through the same thing. So I can't really comment on the magic wand.
Sorry, Chair. One of my questions also in my time was, if you were appointed CEO of Eskom now, what three or four things would you do to turn Eskom around? Thank you.
I would be quite presumptuous. I don't know. I think that you may need something that is completely unusual. That you may need to remove the board fully and the senior exec and get two or three people with full authority to deal with the entity. The value of governance, I would then proceed to break Eskom up. I've never really believed in restructuring Eskom. The restructure thing doesn't solve any problems. And the privatization word gets thrown around. But I would follow the Chinese model and break the generators up in the different parts of Eskom. And I would only do that for one singular reason, the value of governance. You see, all of us underestimate this issue of leadership and governance. And just for having good governance. If that is what it takes to deal with it, then that's what I would do. Because you have a company, I sat in front of investors that's in Los Angeles, in Boston, and we spoke about the governance, and they trusted both the leadership and the governance structure. What happens today with that person that sits in New York or in Boston or everywhere in the world looking at what we're doing? So that is being presumptuous. You asked me about IPPs. When we had choices, so we supported the program. I was there when the initial frameworks were done. No government in this continent, nor in this specific country, can ensure its energy security on its own. It would need the private sector. We should be clear on that. You just need vast investments in energy. And the next thing that's happened is IPPs, by the time that we did that, they were more expensive than Eskom. Today, it's not the same thing. You're not comparing apples with apples. But we have seen significant improvements in cost, significant improvements in technology, I'm convinced that you will find solutions to storage of energy through batteries or other means. And therefore, our future and choices we can make today is different to even what it was in 2010 or in 2012. That's how fast technology is improving. So I would support the private sector. And I'm conflicted, so I must be very clear. Where I'm currently at, I'm totally conflicted. But we have a unique choice to make sure we invest in South Africa's energy future and keep on investing. Don't stop. Keep on being ahead of the curve of electricity demand and electricity supply. But we now can do that with new technologies that's less capital intensive and that the private sector can take some of that risk. And we can use our government funding to focus on our people and deal with the issues of energy access and all of the social issues we have to deal with. You then ask me about the nuclear deal given my background. Where we are today, as a country and as a world, there is absolutely no need for nuclear in South Africa. We don't need it, nor does Finland need it, and they're still trying to build it. The French are still trying to build it. The Americans have just stopped it. We have no need for it. And secondly, I don't think we will ever afford it. And I have personally ran a nuclear procurement for ourselves, for this country and for Eskom, way back in 2007. And after we've seen the prices, we made a recommendation not to proceed. Nor would I go build big coal plants. We're in a unique position where technology that is new, that is clean, with our existing installed capacity that has now ensured that we have energy security as a country. It was very difficult to build these things. When we started this, the country had nothing. We haven't done it for 20 years. We've built it. We've built in this province gas-fired stations. We built pump storage schemes. You have that now. Keep it and add incrementally the new technologies over time.
Chairperson, in the last minute, 10 seconds of the question will be, you said early on that we are a bit too late with this process. We should have started long ago. And I think many of us seated here as members of this committee were not there 5 years ago, except for possibly one or two. What do you think are the consequences of this process having started this late? And I don't mean as late, 3 months late, but you know, what are the consequences that, we can see the consequences, but what do you see as the consequences of this?
I would struggle to answer that. I can also see the consequences, and I think through what is written in the, and I must say what I see, I can't believe. It makes me truly sad, having spent 27 years of my life and having seen colleagues that have spent most of their life. Recently, let me tell you a little story. Recently, somebody came to me and said, I need advice on boiler combustion for some plant. And I said, you know, I know the right person. So I phoned the head of Eskom Research and said, listen, where's Dr. Mark van der Riet? Best brains around boiler combustion ever in the country. Now, this gentleman is suspended for some reason. I just could not believe it. You have this wealth of talent and experience, and what is happening is absolute. I can't tell you the consequences of this process. We've seen what has happened, and as much as you have, I have, and it is sad.
Thank you, Chair. I suppose my time is up.
Up, Honourable Singh, can we go to Honourable Praveen? Honourable Gordon.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to Mr. Thomas for his active citizenship in being with us here today. A couple of questions and you can respond quickly, and some of them will require some explanation. In terms of where you were, where your gradings were in investment grade, you were able to borrow without direct guarantees, compared to today, what sort of premium is being paid on what was interest rates that you paid then compared to now?
I would have to recall. I know that above government bonds or South African bonds at the time, guaranteed and under-guaranteed, we may have had 250 basis points spread between those. I don't know what they currently, what where Eskom gets it, but it would significantly put out the spreads above South African government bonds.
When you became CEO, Minister Hogan was in place. She was then dismissed by the President. Did she ever share with you why she was dismissed and under what pressure she might have been at that point in time?
No.
Any speculation?
No, I mean, she worked with me particularly on the World Cup. I remember the two of us going to the organizing, local organizing committee to say, you know, we've got to deal with Eskom unions, we're going to deal with this. She was, we had a huge amount of respect for her. So no, she did not take me into confidence, and I would be not qualified to speculate.
In 2013, August, Mr. Machila, or slightly before that, became head of the board tender committee, and then seems to have got involved in the generators, in the New Age Breakfast deal, in T-Systems, at least. I mean, what changed during that period from the previous period in terms of good governance, transparency, competitive processes, good pricing, and everything being above board?
The previous board never, I mean, like I said, the Eskom procurement teams would engage with the board, and this was the board of Mr. McQuana, and they were very experienced business people, come in very objectively, look at things, and we had these assessment processes. The sense I had afterwards is that this communication thing, that you had procurement staff talking directly to board members, and you know, they just bypass the negatives. And it was, for me, quite unhealthy. I never had specific proof of that, but it became clear in terms of the questions that we got asked. So, you know, that was a sense that toned the way things was done. The governance was still there, the procedures were still there. It was just the how and the people that then affected that changed.
You mean the formal processes were there, but the content you couldn't account for. Now, similar question in relation to the chairperson of the board, Mr. McQuana versus Mr. Sotsi. What changed? And please try to help us by being a little bit more specific. What is a board chair supposed to do and not supposed to do?
Mr. McQuana obviously had extensive experience in the board, understands the role, the executive role, the non-executive role of the chairman, the executive role of the chief exec. We had a particularly difficult period of Eskom just before Mr. McQuana became the chairman, and out of that we actually had a specific board charter developed that spelled out these roles clearly, who communicates and how that gets done, the role of the chief exec and the role of the chairman. And so where the line stops between, we here to approve strategy. We're not here to set strategy. We're here to approve strategy. We're here to direct things. The role of being a non-executive versus somebody that comes in that becomes a lot more executive. So one of the concerns I have raised, towards the end of my tenure, Minister Gigaba did ask the chairman and I to come to see about our relationship. And he asked the chairman, what's your problem with Brian? And he said, Brian is arrogant. And there was a bit of story around that. And he asked me, what's your problem with the chairman? I said, the chairman is not an executive chairman. He should not involve himself in the operational part of this, meeting with suppliers. That he's a non-executive chairman and should not get in. And I think that is the distinction around experienced members that understand the role as non-executives and, people that become actively involved in the operational aspects.
But, I mean, it was just inexperience that got Mr. Sotsi to now deal with suppliers and the other things that you described, or was it more than that?
I would have to speculate to answer the question. I guess it's a combination of both, but I never had any specific proof as to what it is. Subsequent to me leaving, I certainly had suppliers that said, you know, we were directly engaged and it, we felt it was not correct, and so we now read what we all read. But at the time, I must be honest, you know, I had no specific tangible thing that led to something that more, it's just something that I know was wrong, it was why I left.
So if you have to speculate, not even speculate, just connect the dots, so to speak, between what you know now and what you saw then, what would that amount to?
I think there were influences outside of Eskom for specific purposes to specific individuals or multiple individuals, and it explains some of the behavior. I once read an article, and I must say the journalist has done a stunning job, I mean, too. I must be honest. I know many of them. But I once read an article after I left Eskom in the Mail and Guardian about, not Eskom, about another company. I think it was Transnet. When I read the article about Transnet and procurement and I think it was the chairman of the procurement committee. When I read the article and I reflected back in my experience, I kind of like looked at it that, gee, well, this is actually what was happening while, you know, we were there. So, but only afterwards I could make some of those decisions.
You must have dealt with a lot of international firms that come looking for business, so to speak. Amongst them would be McKinsey, SAP, KPMG, and others that are in the news today. What would your advice be to them to correct their practices and operate with integrity? And what do they do wrong to get into the kind of trouble they've got into?
You know, companies has got governance processes for a reason. I'm sure those has got world-class governance processes, but the people that they have, you should be very careful about the people that engages. I used to, and I know particularly, and after I left Eskom, I did spend time at McKinsey. McKinsey came to me and said we would, I actually had other job offers, and they said to me, you know, why don't you come and spend some time with us to think through your options? And I did. I started my current employer that very same year in 2014 and phased out McKinsey by the end of the year. And I remember in one of the discussions, I used to say to them, even while they were at Eskom, don't get involved in the politics of my company. Don't come and tell me what's happening with the executives. You're here for a specific task. Focus on the task. And so my advice to them is they've got risk functions, risk committees. You know, the people that you engage with, you should do that with utmost care. We're not here to, you know, you should do it with utmost care and value. And I think, and then great transparency. It's, you know, there's no such thing as secrets. I mean, you need to be, if you've got an audit process, follow it absolutely. And listen to the juniors. You know, if people don't have a voice, and they don't have a voice that they can listen to, then you have a problem.
Just one last question. In the overall scheme of state capture, it seems suspension and getting rid of key skilled and professional people is very much part of the scheme. What purpose does that serve from your experience in an entity like Eskom? You referred to a number of people who've been suspended or got rid of for one reason or another.
Yeah, I don't know the reason why they got suspended. Certainly I read that afterwards. But if I would take the head of coal at Eskom, I mean, absolutely brilliant leader, somebody that I would have said, if you look at Eskom succession plans, you would have seen her there and you would have seen her grow. I think she's outside of Eskom today. I think the chief information officer, the IT person, ended up being the best IT person in the country. We recruited him from, I don't know where. And you know, very energetic, you know, he's not there anymore. I don't know about other people, like, and it makes no sense. It absolutely makes zero sense for something like that to happen. If somebody has done something wrong, then deal with it, fire the person, and move on. But not just suspend them and ruin their careers, and now this country has got all the skills, but they're just not where they should be.
Thank you very much, Honorable Pravin. You were just on time. I will now give over to Honorable Nobanda. Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Dumas, when did you, can you give me the exact date of your resignation? Is it May 2013 or March 2014?
I left Eskom end of March 2014.
So what were the reasons you gave when you were resigning?
Reasons I gave when I was resigning? I specifically put emphasis on my family and personal reasons.
And from your reasons when you were resigning and the reasons you just gave us now, that you were not happy, you couldn't vouch. What has changed in between?
Nothing.
Okay. Chair, the Mr. Damas was not able to he was not able to tell us exactly if one of the people he met was the Gupta brothers, and he left in 2014. So from 2014 until now, he still cannot tell us if one of the men he met there was one of the Gupta brothers. And I think the Gupta brothers are in all media, TV, stories, movies, everything. So please ask him to tell us if in that meeting, exactly. Well, I want you to emphasize, because Honorable Shivambu asked and he couldn't answer. So maybe he would rather answer if it comes from you. If one of those men he met was one of the Gupta brothers.
Can you respond to that?
Chair, as I said earlier, you know, I can't recall, and that's my honest view. I've not watched any movies.
Chair.
Oh, where was the meeting, Chair? Maybe we can just know.
He was told to go and meet some people. Then when he met those people, he can't recognize them now that it was one of the Gupta brothers. Because the Gupta brothers, maybe, I take it at that time, they were not in the media or in any movie. So that is why he could not put the pictures together. That it's these three, one of these three that I met before. The question might be, how long have you stayed with these people when you were asked to meet them? Because it depends on maybe on your interaction with them. The interaction with them, how long did it take? Maybe then the questions might arise that you should have recognized them when they are on when they put on publicly who they are.
Or maybe, Chair, just to ask where.
Where did you meet? Where was the meeting? Chair, I'm sure you are not eating up my 10 minutes with Honorable Shizambu. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm having a problem with Mr. Dame's answer. Because I think if I were to meet or have met one of the Gupta brothers in 2005, I'm sure today, if I were to see a picture of one of them, and I would be told that this is one of them, even the name, there might be some sort of recollection that somewhere, somehow, I've met this person or these people. I don't believe that today he cannot recall whether he met the Guptas or he didn't meet the Guptas. Mr. Damas, what are your views on transformation? sorry, in Eskom, and when did you get appointed at McKinsey and something, something?
So coming back to where, Midrand, as I said, I think it was Sahara Computers. Yeah, Midrand. That's what I said earlier, in Midrand. If you give me the pictures, I can say to you which person it wasn't, but I can't positively say to you which of the other brothers it is. It was certainly somebody that was not, at the time, very frequent in the media. So I would speculate if I give you the name. Yeah, I can tell you which brothers it's not, the ones that were in the picture, but other than that, I can...
He's asking to see the picture.
Okay. So if you... But I can say to you which one is not.
Honourable Sir,
but I mean,
you
I can
are eating Nobanda's time. you are wasting Honourable Nobanda's time.
It's not these two gentlemen, but it's quite frequent in the media. First, it's not them.
Honourable Shivambo, he said it's not none of them, so you can't force him. No, don't make him to do what you want him to do. No, if he does not know, we will get to that. Don't worry.
Transformation is hugely important. It's always been important in Eskom, and it still remains important today. This country cannot proceed without making sure that all of our people participate in all aspects of our society, including in business. And that should never stop. It should be continued and should be driven. And it can be done. We've done many of that. It should be done correctly. On the last question, my engagement with McKinsey started after I left Eskom. I can't know if it's April or May, but after I left Eskom. And I phased out at McKinsey by January 2015, that's when I finished. I started my current employee in August, September 2014.
Okay, what was your position at McKinsey when you left Eskom?
I was a senior advisor to McKinsey, worked mainly outside of South Africa, in the Middle East, Saudi, and Africa, and Germany. I did absolutely no work at Eskom or any other state-owned company.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Honourable Nobanda. Honourable Sedi.
Mr. Damas, you know why the Gupta issue came several times here? It's because in your presentation, you indicated that these were the Guptas, but you can't identify them. Even after you have met them, you still can't report this controversial meeting that was convened by the advisor to the minister. And I want to remind you, from what the chairperson read earlier, if some of the issues that you are raising here are found to be problematic, they will create problems for you as well in the near future. So I must remind you this. So you go to a meeting, a controversial meeting, you are not happy with what happened, you don't report it anywhere, you claim these were the Guptas, you can't identify them. I think let's leave it there. But I must remind you, this might create problems for you in the near future. The money that was due to you when you left Eskom, what was the controversy around this money? Because if from the portfolio point of view then, because seemingly even this money was not released immediately, until such time that there were investigations. What was controversial about this money?
The money due to me, I assume you talk about the pension money. There was nothing...
I'm talking about the pension, yes.
There was nothing controversial about it.
Why was it not released immediately?
I was not aware that it was not released. The money was transferred from Eskom to a pension fund, what do they call it? Provident Fund. And that is it.
The audit opinions, what are some of the issues that kept on coming, despite the fact that the company was not qualified? What are some of the matters of emphasis from the auditor point of view then, which kept on coming while you were the CEO?
Like I said, I can't recall those. We can go look at the Eskom annual reports. They're all in the Eskom annual reports. If they're there, they should be stated there.
The 1.7 billion that you spoke about earlier, that you raised, where was this money raised from?
The $1.7 billion, or $1.75 if I can recall correctly, was raised from investors through a US dollar bond issue that was a $4 billion program, and that was the first part of it.
The 51% that was said to be a directive, when is that? Because there's a bit of a problem there. That you said is supposed to be black-owned. It came as a directive. You later said it was an agreement. And upon your investigation, you realized there is no agreement. Can you try and deal with this particular issue? Directive vis-a-vis agreement.
So the 51% ownership was the directive from the board as to the ownership of the new, I think you talk about Nulagro. There was an engagement with the chairman of Eskom, the chairman of the Eskom procurement committee, with the chairman of a specific company. It was reported back to me that there was an agreement that that is the case. I asked for that to be confirmed in writing so that the teams can start work on it and engage with the company. And when the response came back, the company clearly indicated that there was no such agreement.
There's this issue of a directive to change a recommendation from the tender committee that you spoke about earlier. There was a calling issue involved there. By the time you resigned, or after you have resigned, what happened to that particular aspect? Seemingly by the time you resigned, this matter has not yet been concluded. Upon your investigation, what ended up happening to this particular aspect?
Yeah, I did not investigate anything. So by the time I resigned, the matter was not concluded. So you're absolutely correct. What we all read in the newspapers is the matter went to court, numerous court cases, including the Constitutional Court, that found in favor of Eskom.
What's your take on the massive electricity price increase? That yesterday we talked about 400% increase. What's your take on that?
I've not looked at the actual application, so it is high. I have not looked at the data and the merits of the application, so it will be difficult for me to comment on that, but it seems high.
Some of the documents at our disposal, they've got about 20 billion maintenance budget that disappeared somewhere around 2010. I'm not sure whether it was after you have been appointed CEO or before. Do you know anything about it?
Not to my knowledge. If that is the case, then it should have been reported at Eskom, should have been investigated, and if it is the case, it should be investigated.
I'm concluding, Chair. What are the key issues that, in your view, you will say have changed after you have resigned from Eskom in terms of how, from the governance point of view, key issues that has changed since you left Eskom, from the governance point of view?
Quite a difficult question, because I can't comment as to what's happening inside. I can just read like all of us, as to what's happening. I think, as I said earlier, losing a large part of the executive with the experience would be one aspect that would impact it. I mean, the rest is what all of us read in the newspapers. I think having a...
That's exactly what I'm interested in, from what we are reading, all of us, from your... Yeah, that is the point that I'm talking about. What are the key issues that you see to have changed from the governance point of view after you have left the company?
I think the stability around the executive is one specific issue. I think, you know, you're really asking me to speculate from the newspapers. I mean, it seems like the processes were there, were not followed. The issue around suspension of executives, I mean, that would be unusual.